It's been a long time coming, but after years of lobbying, Australia is about to see the first clinical trial studying the effects of psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, on mental health. Similar trials conducted in the US, Europe and Canada indicate that psychedelics, a broad category of drugs that includes LSD, mescaline and MDMA, have therapeutic benefits on a range of disorders, including anxiety, depression and PTSD. But such studies, and indeed the whole field of psychedelic science, still faces huge resistance. In the popular imagination, psychedelic drugs remain linked to the 1960s counterculture, dangerous, recreational and illegal. Can that change? Dr. Martin Williams is research fellow in medicinal chemistry at Monash University. He's also president of PRISM, and that stands for Psychedelic Research in Science and Medicine. And he's been key to getting the Australian trial off the ground. Martin joins us now here in Sydney. Martin, welcome.
Hello, thanks, Liz.
And also, we have the pleasure of the company of Professor David Nutt. He joins us from London. He is Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College, and he's the former Chief Drugs Advisor to the UK government. Now, David, remember, has been a long-term researcher on the effects of drugs on the brain, which is absolutely fascinating. And David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So, David Nutt, let's come to you first of all. I first heard you talking about this on a colleague's program, All in the Mind, not so long ago, in fact. And, you know, I was driving home, I downloaded this podcast, and I was really surprised to hear the things that you were saying about psychedelic drugs actually being quite useful potentially in the treatment of mental illness.
Well, that's right. We started studying them about 15 years ago, largely from the perspective of trying to understand what the nature of the psychedelic experience was. Those brain research studies showed that psychedelics could actually affect the brain in ways which potentially could be useful for therapy. And about 5 years ago, we did the first study of magic mushrooms and depression, and the effect was very powerful. People who had failed to respond to conventional treatments did surprisingly well following a single dose of psilocybin. And since then, the field has really blossomed now. There's a multi-centre trial going on across many different countries in Europe, and it could be that magic mushrooms become a treatment for depression in the next few years.
So how widely were psychedelics used as a treatment option in the 50s and the 60s?
Oh, there was huge research. Particularly the one that was most studied was LSD. There were, I think, 1,000 papers published on the effects of LSD and mental illness, most of them funded by the US government. There were trials across the range of psychiatric disorders, not just anxiety and depression, but particularly effective studies in addiction. It was widely used. It was seen as a revolution, and until, as you pointed out in your introduction, it started being used by the counterculture. Actually, the counterculture, we would now say, was the right culture, because the counterculture was just against the Vietnam War and against Nixon. But of course, that was seen as very, very dangerous. And that's, the drugs were banned because they changed the way people's attitude to war, basically.
Now, Martin, in the 1990s, there were some new trials in the US to study the effects of psychedelic on anxiety disorders. What do you think has led to this resurgence now in 2019?
I think there were a number of forces at play. Basically, gradually, amongst some parts of society, the war on drugs was starting to wear rather thin, and I think people were starting to really see the limitations of the war on drugs. The war on drugs was based on the pretext that these compounds, these chemicals, were dangerous, that they had no medicinal value and they had high abuse potential. And many people realised that just simply wasn't the case. Many of these drugs had prior medicinal applications before they were basically arbitrarily outlawed for political reasons more than anything else. And so eventually the public became, some parts of the public and particularly the research community became a little more accepting of the possibility that these drugs might be worth exploring, as David mentioned just a couple of minutes ago. And the other thing, of course, is that there had been, and there still continues to be to a large degree, a stigma around the use of these drugs, but some researchers were brave and courageous enough to actually try and break through that stigma and just keep exploring until they achieved the research results that they, I'm sure they knew were going to be coming anyway. And once they were able to communicate those results, then that started to pick up a bit of a snowball effect and things have rolled on from there.
It's so interesting, isn't it, that the image of a drug could be so significant in terms of its development or lack of development. Because one of the things, David, I remember from listening to that interview of my colleagues with you was, you know, you were saying things that were completely new to me about psychedelics, that they weren't as addictive, for example, as people perceive them to be. In fact, not really addictive at all.
If anything, they're anti-addictive. Their efficacy in treating other forms of addiction, like alcoholism and nicotine tobacco addiction, is actually surprisingly powerful.
What are your hopes for this research in Melbourne? What do you really hope will come about as a result of this trial that will kick off in Melbourne?
Well, in the first instance, we really want to start helping people who are currently not well served by the treatment options. And so this first trial will be treating people who are suffering intractable anxiety and depression associated with their terminal illness. And so that's been a very fruitful area of research in the US so far. So two main sites, New York University and Johns Hopkins University on the East Coast, have both completed very successful phase two trials. We're hoping to extend those results by changing some of the protocols just very slightly. We're actually moving beyond cancer diagnosis to non-malignant or non-cancer disease. We're looking at a slightly different trial design now so that we're going to achieve better statistical significance. And really, as I said, we first want to help people who are currently not being very well helped, but of course we would like to pave the way to further research and eventually, hopefully, clinical practice application of these approaches in Australia and, of course, well beyond Australia as well.
Have you called for volunteers?
We're not quite at that stage yet.
I don't think you'll be short of numbers.
We'll be short of numbers. No, that's very true. I'm sure plenty of people would be very interested. But of course, as with any clinical trial, we have pretty strict inclusion and exclusion criteria. So we have to be very careful that the people who are on our trial are suitable, that they don't have other possibly problematic mental health conditions, for example, that they're actually healthy enough to see through the trial to its conclusion. And that's really the paradox of this. We're helping people who are terminally ill, but unfortunately they have to be able to survive long enough to see the treatment through. So it's quite a tricky area to navigate in setting up a trial like this.
David, how do these drugs work on the brain to alleviate anxiety?
Well, I can answer that question at a number of levels. I mean, we know that pharmacologically they target a receptor in the brain, a particular subtype of the serotonin receptor called the 5-HT2A receptor. And this receptor is massively expressed. There's loads of them in the brain, particularly in the very high levels of the brain where we do our thinking and our feeling and our making sense of the world. And our current theory is that when people get locked into syndromes like anxiety and depression, it's because they get into the brain gets locked into a routine it can't disengage from. And what psychedelics do by stimulating those 5-HT receptors, they disrupt any kind of negative, learnt, repetitive thinking processes. They disrupt it to a point where you can no longer have them while you're tripping. And then, for reasons we don't fully understand, when you come out of that, your brain can often work normally again. So it's as if you've kind of disrupted some negative thought processes and let the brain go back to its kind of base state. And so then you can view the world as you used to, which was not as a nasty, threatening place. But there is one other point I want to make, and this is particularly relevant to Martin's study, which is that psychedelics don't just disrupt what we call negative thinking. They also, in the end, alter certainly in some people, the way people view their relationship with the rest of the world. People during a psychedelic experience can often see that the bigger picture. They can see that it, actually they are part of a bigger entity called the world or the universe. And it's at the end of life, that can be very powerful and reassuring to people.
Do you have any concerns about using these drugs? I mean, we've spoken about their potential use for good, but do they have traits about them that are particularly worrying?
Well, not particularly worrying. I mean, we know that millions of people have used psychedelics relatively safely. They just haven't talked about it because the stigma.
It's illegal.
Well, that's right. Exactly. And some parts of some cultures can turn viciously. You know, some of the media can be very hateful to people who even admitted breaking the law many years ago. But yes, they can be dangerous. They're powerful drugs, and not everyone has a what you might call a good trip. In fact, our experience is when we're treating people with mental illness, sometimes the trips are not enjoyable at all. But afterwards, people feel that they've seen a better picture, they've sorted out things in their mind, they've come to terms with the reasons for their depression, etc. And we always do it in a careful, controlled hospital environment. We have therapists present, so if people do have a bad or are having a bad experience, there's someone there to help them, reassure them, and guide them. And so far, we've been fortunate, and we haven't had anyone have a trip which needed to be stopped, for instance, because it was too challenging.
Would you be able to stop it?
Yes, very easily. Actually, that's one of the great people. The pharmacology is well known. We could inject someone with a commonly used medicines like risperidone. They will stop a trip instantly because they block the receptors that the psychedelics work on. I think the risks have been exaggerated and the benefits have been minimized. So the benefit risk in this kind of research is actually so far seems to be one of the strongest benefit risks that we have in terms of drugs treating the brain.
Particularly, just to interrupt, because these drugs are really only given on one or two occasions, and the results seem to be the benefits seem to be accruing for extended periods of time. And this is in contrast to standard pharmacological interventions, in which somebody might be given an anxiolytic or an antidepressant pretty much every day for the rest of their lives. In many cases, so these in many ways represent a far safer alternative, as it happens.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that, Martin, how many trips might a volunteer expect to have, but really only one or two, potentially.
That's correct, yes, yes.
And then the effects are permanent? Is that what you're hoping?
Permanent is a long time, of course. And so in the research that's been completed to date, it's been found that the majority of the people do show benefit for extended periods of time, which might extend to 12 months, 2 years, 3 years, or longer. But inevitably, some people will tend to relapse into their prior state. So it might be a mild or moderate depression rather than a severe intractable depression, for example. And so it may be necessary as time goes on to revisit, so to administer another dose, but that's likely to be required only after, say, 2 years rather than 2 days or 2 weeks or whatever it might be with a standard pharmacological intervention. So from that point of view, the majority of people will benefit for extended periods of time. And part of that may be, as I understand it, there seems to be quite a strong positive correlation between the intensity of a positive experience, which sometimes sort of spills over into almost the mystical or spiritual realm, and the psychological benefit that accrues from these treatments. So in some cases, it's actually the intensity of the psychedelic experience, which is correlated with the benefit long term.
And do you think that psychedelics will be, as useful in treating depression as they are in anxiety?
There's better evidence for depression than anxiety at present, and also because anxiety can respond very well to psychological interventions, whereas the depressed people we're treating, they've all had psychological treatments, they've all had CBT. They've not found it helpful. So my particular target, and we're doing another trial now, we're comparing a psychedelic, two doses of a psychedelic, with a full course of the strongest antidepressant called escitalopram. And in a year's time, we'll know whether there's a difference in effect. But more importantly, we'll be able to see how the brain effects of these two treatments are different, and I believe they're fundamentally different. And that's why I'm so excited by psychedelics, because I think they offer a completely new avenue to deal with people's psychological distress. And that's why they would be particularly, I think, powerful in end-of-life problems.
Gentlemen, it's been a great pleasure talking to you both. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure for me too. Thank you. Good luck, Martin. Well done.
Thank you very much, sir.
Dr. Martin Williams, a research fellow in medicinal chemistry at Monash University, and Professor David Nutt, Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College in London.